Live from Dürber, this is the Locked In Podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
Today we're covering John 9:22 and chapter 22 and 23 of Nona the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. We are covering a lot today, starting with a quick dip back into John Apocalypse Land, followed by Nona playing dress up and ending with a duel.
Oh. And as always, if you want to support artists in the Locked Tomb fan community, you can check out our Locked Tomb creator hub at locktombpod.com/fanmerch. I think there's a couple new folks who joined the website. And then, as always, if you want to support Amy and me here at the pod, you can find stickers, pins, magnets on our website, or you can just donate to us. I am so far behind sending things out to people because there's no real excuse other than...
You have a baby, dude.
I haven't been able to do it. Anyway, I know I'm behind. I love you all. I promise you'll get your merch. But thank you for being patient with me. We were able to cover last year's fees. So that's like hosting our website, domain, our podcast service. So thanks, y'all, for supporting us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
All right. Amy, before we get started, what does Electo call dead bodies?
What?
Dinner. It's not a pun, but it's what I could do with what I had today.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in this first chapter here, about how... Yeah, she seems to be suggesting that they just kind of chomp down on all of John's friends.
I mean, bodies decompose into the earth. That's what she's used to. So You really can't, you can't blame her.
Right.
But let's get into it.
Yeah. So speaking of Electo and bodies, let's get into John 9:22. So before this chapter, we had the cipher saying the tower has react. And now we have an I and a V for reactive. So that's where we're at with the cipher. And I would say, Mel, that this is the chapter where John really goes from being a flawed human who I think generally means well and is just confused and overwhelmed. I mean, serious, serious issues. But this is the chapter where he just like straight up becomes like an evil dude.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I agree. I think in my notes in the margins of the book, I wrote, John is a sociopath. I always have felt that way. And I know we've debated this for this entire podcast. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is the moment where I feel very validated that he doesn't have any remorse. And We'll get there because even after 10,000 years, it seems... I'm not seeing a lot of remorse here, which is pretty, it's intense.
I know. Yeah, it's not great. But this chapter starts with John and the narrator finally approaching that concrete wreck that he's been avoiding. And they clear the door with their bare hands, which I assume he could have used magic, but he doesn't. And, you know, this concrete wreck is the facility, his facility where he was originally working on the cryo project with his buds. And it's the same facility where all of this shit has gone down, sort of the epicenter of the apocalypse, as it were.
Right. And there's all sorts of bodies and bones everywhere. These are human bodies. Some still have their muscle and fat and all of that on them, and some are completely wiped clean. And this is what Amy and I were just talking about, where Electo points to the bones and says that they still have meat on them. Yeah. And John said to stop. And we're pretty sure that Electo is insinuating that they should eat the meat.
Yeah.
On the bones.
She doesn't know any better.
She doesn't know. She's not human. Right. So it's not really cannibalism for Electo to want to eat people.
True. It is for John, though. Let's keep in mind.
Yeah. That's where he draws the line. We found John's line.
He won't eat his own friends. So John picks up where he left off with the story, and he's talking about how people are starting to come and join them. You know, they've gathered a couple of thousand. people in and around the facility. The UN is trying to fly troops in and New Zealand is pissed. And also, John is growing the wall, the cow wall outwards, and they were taking in whoever they can. And Augustine, or A, is really freaked out because it seems like John is creating matter out of nothing when he's building this wall.
Right. This is perpetual bone, I think, mm-hmm. which is what the terminology becomes much later when necromancy is part of his universe. But yeah, he has figured out basically how to take a small piece of bone, like what Harrow does, and like grow it. So it's pretty creepy because before it seemed like he was working within the parameters of physics. And he's not anymore. So even his BFF is pretty freaked out by this.
Right. And this is one of those moments where this book is science fiction, but also it's not hard science fiction. It's not going to try and explain exactly why it is that John can create matter out of nothing. But yeah, of course, Augustine, who is a scientist, is concerned about this. But one thing that John can't do is he can't figure out the soul. I think it's in Harrow where John says soul is the great leveler. And, you know, he's experienced this firsthand. He's got the flesh magic, the bone magic, all of that stuff down, but he can't really figure out how the body is connected to the soul.
Yeah. And this is where I think there's a mention of Christabel. Mm-hmm. You know, Christabel is the one who ends up working with John on the soul more closely, which actually this makes sense to me. Maybe this was obvious to everyone else, but at first when I learned in the reading that Mercy was the eighth house, I was like, that's so weird. Mercy Morn doesn't seem like that into spirit. I don't know. She's an anatomist. She's whatever. But Christabel is all about the soul.
Right.
And so it does make sense that Mercy Morn is the eighth house because of the parts of her that are Christabel. So John can't figure out the soul. And a couple people die and he sees something. And this is when he realized that killing was like crack cocaine.
Uh-huh.
And he makes sure to say that he's never had crack cocaine before. But like this is what he imagines it was like. And he essentially like, it's like, if you have an addiction, if you have just a little bit of a taste of something, then you're very much at risk for continuing to go and mm-hmm. overdo it. And this is basically what happens to John here.
Yeah, and that's when we come to the incident where John really gets murderous. So from what I understand, some more people have come and want to join John and friends, but they aren't let in. There are like cops outside trying to keep people from going in. And the crowd is exchanging fire with the cops. And this is when those five people die that Mel just mentioned in this exchange that, you know, John wasn't a part of. But then John senses that death energy, which is later named Thanergy, and he uses this energy to kill everyone with a gun within a kilometer radius. And that's over 100 people.
It is wild how precise he can be with that.
Right.
He was able to be selective for up to 100 people.
Yeah.
And just drop them. I mean, that is so much power.
Right. And the only reason that he kind of comes out of that is that Pyrrha starts shaking him. And she's really pissed because all of these cops that he just killed were her drinking buddies, basically. Like, she knows these people. And she's just like, you can't be making mistakes like this. And John is like, no, it was an accident. I'm learning, like, get off my back, basically. And Pyrrha finally lets him be, even though she's pissed.
Yeah, I feel like the writing here is really cool because Pyrrha's like, someone as careful as you shouldn't be making mistakes like this. And then that is echoed in a few lines. So John is retelling this story. Mm-hmm. To, we think, Harrow.
Harrow Electo, yeah.
Harrow Electo. But in this next part, Harrow Electo asks, did you ever find out what happened with your accident? So this is in quotes. We think that that means that at this exact moment, Jod is talking to Harrow.
Right.
And he turns to her and smiles and says, "Come on, love. Guys as careful as me don't have accidents." I mean, he meant to do this. And he's admitting it here, too. This was not an accident.
Right. We've mentioned this a couple of times, but if you haven't listened to the Homestuck episode, which you definitely should, we're talking with the quotes. We think that when things are in quotes, John is talking to Harrow. It's like a memory of a memory. It's weird. It's like it's layered, but when they're in quotes, that's him talking to Harrow specifically. Whereas when he talks and it's not in quotes, it's a memory of him talking to Electo. So just to make sure everyone's on the same page.
Yeah.
It's a Homestuck thing, which is so freaking cool.
Yeah. I think Nikki was the first one that pointed that out to us. So
yeah. Yeah. Stowe and Nikki, who are both Homestuck fans and talked to us on that episode, were so helpful in understanding this stuff. And that ends John 9:22.
So now we get to the goods. I think that these two chapters here mark for me the beginning of where I just started having a blast with this book. I mean, I enjoyed the book, but I think because we get some quality time with some old friends, and I am very happy about it as a major Ianthe fan.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're happy whenever Ianthe shows up. In like a really twisted way.
Yeah. So we are on chapter 22, and basically the essence of this chapter is that Nona is dressed up like Harrow as part of a plan to get Gideon's body back and to rid this planet of Ianthe temporarily.
Yeah.
And she and Cam go to the barracks to enter into Ianthe's domain.
Yeah, so we've had a couple of makeovers in these books, and this is our, our Nona the Ninth makeover.
It's such a good one.
I know. Nona is basically in drag as a ninth house nun, is great because she looks exactly like Harrow.
Yeah.
But also on top of being dressed in black and having her head shaved, We Suffer has also put dye and foggy contacts in her eyes, so it looks like she's blinded herself, which is a ploy, because if it were actually Harrow, she would be insane because of the presence of the Resurrection Beast. But they're hoping that pretending to be blinded
throws Ianthe off a little
bit. Yeah.
Like, no one actually fully knows for sure how effective the blinding is at this point in the book, but it is an educated guess by Pal and Cam. Because as a reminder, no one else has a necromantic body in this little crew here, other than, wait a minute, Pyrrha does.
Well, yeah, it's explained at the beginning of the book, but it's not the right combination of souls and bodies.
Right.
But Harrow herself and her own body would definitely be affected by the Resurrection Beast.
Right. Great clarification.
And Nona is not, because she is a Resurrection Beast herself. So she's actually immune, which is great for her. And then we can't forget that when they do find the sixth house, spoiler, they find the sixth house.
Yeah.
They've blinded themselves as well.
Right.
So they're not the only people to have thought of this.
Right.
And not only has Cam dressed Nona up, but she's also made all these rules for Nona to follow, which are really funny. Like, never ask for help. Never look at me like I could ever help you with anything. Don't smile.
Yeah.
Yes, no answers.
This is such a good scene for me, especially like as a queer person, because it just shows you how your swagger, your energy, like your mannerisms really add to your appearance in a way. Like, you can look a certain way, but everything else about you makes you who you are. It's not just what's on your body. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's so fascinating that Nona is just so clearly Nona, even though she's in Harrow's body. It's like anyone who knows Harrow would know within a second that this was not Harrow. And you can see that, you know, when Nona meets Gideon immediately knows it's not Harrow, right? I don't know. This is just, I really appreciate this part of the Locked Tomb series in general around what are bodies anyway?
Right.
Bodies are both everything and also not everything. This is just another example of that.
Yeah. Also, Mel, I forgot in regards to the blinding thing, I had a question for you. So We Suffer is asking like, wow, does this really work to blind someone? We didn't know this. I'm glad we didn't. We would have shot everyone who's blind. And Cam says in response to this, it's pure theory. Something's being transmitted in the light spectrum. Absorption through the eyes is worse for the brain. And then it says, this made Nona think of something. It tugged at the edges of her memory and stayed there, nagging. And I was like, what?
Yeah, I've been really thinking about this too. The only theory I have, and I'm curious what y'all think, is the absorption test. What was it? Isn't there like an absorption sort of test in the in all the experiments that the like core group before they became lictors were doing? It's like part of one of the steps in the Eightfold Word.
Absorb the soul.
Yeah, something like that. But I don't know why eyes. I mean, there's a lot around eyes in these books and how their eyes change when lictorhood happens. But I thought this could be a reference to those experiments.
Interesting.
And absorption specifically. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, I do wonder. It's a good point about the eyes changing. I wonder if in the science, magic science of this world, if the reason for absorbing the light through the eyes is worse for the necromancer is the same sort of thing that happens when eyes change. Like it's like from the same theory or something.
Right.
I don't know. Right. Let us know what you guys think. I have no idea what she's thinking about.
Yeah, I love these little, like, Danson Muir just, like, drops these little bombs in casually, and then we go about the story.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what's really cute about this is that We Suffer is the one applying Nona's eye stuff.
Right.
And I think We Suffer's like, I was always really good at camouflage or something. I just love that we're calling this everything but a makeover. Like, this is actually camouflage. Like, no, this is a makeover. But aside from We Suffer and Pash, who are part of this, most of Blood of Eden are too afraid to be in the same room as Nona. So Pash made a barrier and is really annoyed by everyone else who's totally not being logical about what's possible for them. Pash is basically like, if Nona wanted to destroy all of them, she could. This barrier would do nothing.
Right.
So yeah. Pash, as usual, is grumpy AF. But aside from that, Nona has a major crush.
I know. Nona's really been back and forth with Pash. But right now she's crushing hard, and her there's one part that says like her heart beat romantically when she looks at Pash. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah. Nona has such broad taste in people.
Yeah. So we have Cam and Pal going off into a corner to exchange notes back and forth, obviously in the same body, but switching what soul is sitting in the body. And then in a typical twist for Nona the Ninth, Cam and Nona take a nap. And when they wake up, they're continuing to discuss Nona's job here. And Cam is telling her to only answer Anthe's questions with yes or no. And then also says that she should pretend to have the blue madness and act like Judith if asked anything difficult.
Yeah.
I'm also assuming that when Pal and Cam are exchanging notes that they're solidifying their plan to take over Nibirius's body.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also Cam has to lay down afterwards, and she says it's because she's, you know, whatever, soul tired because of the constant back and forth. But I think it's also an emotional response and the anticipation of potentially like merging with Palamedes.
Yeah. 100%. Oh man, I'm so excited to talk about when he gets here and the unwanted guest and everything. Anyway, getting ahead of myself. All right, so Cam also had told Nona that her main job was to be a distraction, which distraction is capitalized. I love all of these like things that are capitalized throughout this book. And We Suffer is very much part of this plan and says that they will provide the getaway after this plan unfolds. And apparently on the side here, Ctesiphon Wing breached one of Merv Wing's cells like 2 hours ago and started interrogating Merv Wing.
Right.
And so We Suffer is saying that Pash will accompany them. And Pash has a very strong reaction to this suggestion.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I just read this part? Because I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
Okay. So We Suffer tells Pash that she's going with them. And it says, Pash's knife stopped and she said, "No, I won't. I'm on duty. Your duty and I have had a talk and they would like to be present," said We Suffer smoothly. "They shouldn't go anywhere near that super zombie," said Pash, incredibly startled. "Commander, fuck this. I'm taking them to the safe house the moment dusk hits." Then We Suffer says, "I'm not telling you this as any kind of command. I'm telling you that I have been served my marching orders." And AIM says that AIM desires to oversee this operation from a place of safety next to their lifeguard. "You are the only lifeguard on duty as Merv Wing is currently suffering unavoidable pangs, courtesy of us."
Yeah. So who's really in charge here? One, the messenger.
Right. I think that this is great evidence that whatever it is inside of the angel, AIM, the messenger, like whatever other soul or implant or whatever is inside of her is able to autonomously interact with other people. Almost, it seems like in a Palamides Cam sort of way, like they could switch. But yeah, I don't think that the angel, the science teacher, is the one calling the shots. I think that she's just a lady. But whatever she's carrying is in charge, right?
Oh, interesting.
That was what I got from this, but what were you thinking?
That's interesting. I didn't think about it like that. But I mean, I thought about it all as one person who is actually in charge.
Yeah.
And she's carrying something.
Yeah.
But maybe, yeah, I don't know. It could be anything. People are all broken up across all sorts of different bodies and multiple parts of themselves in these books. So it's really hard to say, but I appreciate your take on that. And I think no matter what, the hierarchy is clear here,
right?
In that AIM, or whoever AIM is, has ultimate authority over at least these wings of Blood of Eden, if not the whole of Blood of Eden. And it's kind of cute that this person with this much power is doing things like teaching science to little kids while all of this other stuff is going on, which I think would maybe be good evidence for your theory here that that person is one part of this body, but in fact, there are others.
Yeah, because remember when they find out that Nona and the angel have been in the same place this whole time, and Pash is like, "Oh, you just wanted to be a she for once." And the angel is like, "I am honored to be a they." And I guess Pash reads it as like, the only reason you're teaching these kids is so that you can have autonomy and be just, you know, whoever you, the single human, are.
Right.
Minus whatever additions have been done. Also, I was going to say, we got a message from Meg, and they say that, "I was under the impression that the angel had more than one bodyguard and they took shifts. It would explain why Pash didn't make the connection between Nona and BOE until they were all in the classroom together."
Yeah.
And we've kind of talked about this before. I think Meg is right. And I think this confirms it, because it seems like there are several lifeguards, maybe one from each wing.
Yeah.
And they share that duty. And right now, Pash is the only lifeguard because they've like taken over Merv Wing.
Right. Totally. Yeah.
So thanks, Meg. I think you're right.
Yep.
Or at least I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree with you too, Meg. That makes everything else make much more sense.
Yeah. Oh, and my gosh. And then one more thing. Pash, after this, Pash says, "But the messenger shouldn't be near the..." And then it cuts off. And We Suffer says, "They may have a working shuttle, Pash. Quiet, please." What is she going to say? And why does Tamsimir always take it away from us when it's right there?
Keep us on our toes for years. This is the longest cliffhanger ever. Yeah, I think we probably agree on this. Our shared assumption is that this is maybe about the package that we suffer once Cam to take off world, if they get off world. And so I think what Pash is saying here is the messenger and the package should not be near each other. And I don't know if that's because if they don't want to risk both being destroyed, mm-hmm. right? They want to preserve at least one of those things is very important. Mm-hmm. But if that is the case, it's interesting that we suffer cut Pash off here because it seemed like we suffer was going to tell Cam and Pal about the package previously before we suffer got cut off. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's so confusing, right? Because it seemed like we suffer was about to tell them something that she wanted taken off world and was totally willing at that moment to tell them exactly what was going on, or at least to give them some sort of analogy to help them understand. But now seems to be playing it very close to the chest with whatever Pash is about to say. Is Pash about to say, but the messenger shouldn't be near Gideon? Like, near the key to the locked tomb? And if so, why? Yeah, if anyone has thoughts about this, let us know. I mean, I think this is probably something that by the end of Electo the Ninth, we'll have a better idea of. Unlike some of these things where I'm like, we'll probably never know.
Or the answer is already here and our reading comprehension just hasn't gotten us that far.
Yeah, true.
So then we suffer turns to Cam and says, you are certain one simple touch. And this is referring to the whole plan that Cam and Pal have created around like getting Pal to jump into Nibirius's body and kind of fight Ianthe's soul.
Right.
But I completely missed this on my first and second read that this was alluded to here. So they've already developed their plan and set us up very beautifully for the unwanted guest here. And We Suffer knows about it. So Cam and Pal are really entrusting We Suffer with actually a lot of information. Mm-hmm. But Nona still doesn't know anything about this, which I'm assuming because Nona's not great at keeping secrets.
Yeah, or maybe it's just like too much information.
Too advanced.
Or it's just a narrative device to make sure that we, the audience, the readers, stay in the dark.
Sure.
But they seem to have a plan, and We Suffer sends them off saying, crack the sky, Troya Cell. And I was like, is this a reference to the 70s rock band?
What 70s rock?
Crack the Sky.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. I just wonder.
Anything is possible.
Anything is possible. Maybe, yeah, maybe Tamsin Muir's a huge fan of Crack the Sky. Yeah, and then they get in the truck with the grill, the same one they were in on the way back from the broadcast. And it's Nona, Cam, Aim, Noodle, and Pash. What a crew.
Yeah. Power squad.
And by the way, I think we're going to do a separate episode covering a lot of these theories around AIM and stuff, because there's so much. But we have gotten a lot of people writing in saying that they think that Noodle is the message or very important. So Noodle is here and Noodle is coming along.
Noodle is a main character.
Yeah.
So then there's a fun description of how Nona is feeling right now. She was beginning to feel like a floating balloon on a string with a weight tied to the end, the balloon bobbing, the weight dragging behind. She was the balloon and also the string, but she wasn't sure she was still the weight. Mm-hmm. What does this mean?
Well, I think it's just another sign that Nona / Electo is separating from Hera's body. She's been in there for 6+ months and she's starting to... You know, souls want to return to their bodies, and Electo's soul is wanting to return to Electo's body. And I think she is the balloon, Electo's soul, and the string, the whatever is tying her to Hera's body. But I think the weight is Hera's body, which is not really hers.
Right.
And it's just kind of a separate thing that she's just connected to right now.
Yeah. And so Nona's feeling these feels. Mm-hmm. And Pash asks Cam what the chances are that they succeed. And Cam says 50-50, which honestly surprises. It always surprises me because Cam and Pal always seem like they always know what's going on. They're always so confident and it all works out. But she says on a bad roll, she dies, which is like pretty a real bummer here. And Cam has been returned her swords from Blood of Eden and Gideon's sunglasses, and she puts them all on.
Right. At the beginning of the book, there's some mention of Cam's secret knife stash, and it seems like Cam finally has her beloved knives with her. I also want to point out that Cam says on a bad roll, she dies. And at the end of the day, Cam does die. I don't think it's a bad roll, but she like, you know, she becomes Paul. And in a way,
she transforms.
She transforms.
She transforms.
But I would call her role a, if we're playing D&D, I would call her role like maybe a 15. Like, this is not a natural 20.
Right.
She would have loved to have touched Ianthe without getting stabbed through the stomach.
Yeah, it was a messy way to get to the outcome that they had hoped for.
Yeah. But she does it.
Yeah.
And it seems like Pash, who I think despite her best efforts is starting to kind of like Cam and the crew.
Yeah.
Is looking kind of tortured and then out of nowhere says, die quick, die cold, bring them with you. Which I assume is sort of a mantra of Blood of Eden that they say to each other.
Yeah.
May the force be with you kind of vibe.
Exactly.
And Cam tries to shake her hand and Pash is like, nope.
Yeah. And so Cam and Nona get out of the vehicle and they walk the rest of the way. So I think, Emmy, you were asking about why Aim and Pash came along to begin with. Why did they just drop them off? I assumed here that they were like on call for the getaway.
Yeah, but I guess so. Because it's weird because then after all of this, it's not like they go back to this car. Weesuffer comes and gets them with like a truck. So I guess maybe there was a plan in which this all goes perfectly and they're able to get on the shuttle. But instead of that, what happens is that Gideon is actually alive, sort of, and Cam is stabbed through the stomach. I think that the plan does not go, it doesn't go exactly as planned.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't understand why they're in this car and like drop them off nearby after all of the like, we're going with you thing.
Right.
So Cam and Nona head the rest of the way on foot and they reach the barracks. They're let through the gates without any questioning, unlike when Crown entered. And there's a description of the building. It seems very grand, but very worn down. And the interior, when they go through the front doors, is totally dark, but there's a light coming from like one of the side rooms in this dark hallway. So they go through that door and it's an interesting, if you think about like what this room looks like, it seems like a very grand hall that maybe once was filled with very nice furniture, but all of the furniture has been pushed as if by like a tidal wave to the side in just a jumble. So there's like an aisle of cleared space with this mountain of weird furniture on either side.
You can almost imagine Ianthe just waving an arm or getting all her dead bodies to just throw everything off to the side. She realizes Coronabeth is here and she's like, wah!
Yeah.
Wah!
Exactly. And at the end of this cleared walkway, there's this raised dais, just like the one from the broadcast. And seated up there are Nibirius, Ianthe, Pyrrha, and Crown. And in her mind, Nona is thinking that Crown is looking hot, like really hot.
Yeah, Crown has a beautiful gown on. Yeah. I'm like, where did we get these clothes?
I don't know.
I'm assuming Ianthe brought some gowns.
I don't know.
It's so funny. Crown's looking hot and fresh.
She's also looking like she's been crying, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And behind them are a line of dead puppeted soldiers that I think somewhere it says that it looks like they've been dead for some time.
Mm-hmm.
It smells bad in here also.
Yeah, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
Because as a reminder, Ianthe has like set up shop in the house's barracks.
Right.
And there's been fighting for a really long time here. So she actually comes in and has a wealth of dead bodies as a resource to her.
Right. And we have to remember that any necromancer in here has been going crazy, like literally going insane since the resurrection beast showed up. So there's probably been a lot of infighting and people just dying from that.
Totally.
So, I mean, they've been hit from both sides. Not that I really feel bad for them, but yeah, there were definitely plenty of dead people to work with.
Yep.
And a note that Nona thinks at first that it's not actually Pyrrha, but then Pyrrha moves in a way that Nona can tell that it is Pyrrha. So this is our hint that Pyrrha is pretending to be Gideon the First.
Right. Which, again, is like one of those things where it's like about swagger and mannerisms and all of that that can indicate who you are. And then the chapter ends I love this line because it just reminds me of Harrow the Ninth, you know? And I'm like, I felt like, But yeah. Ianthe says, "You're nearly a minute late, Harry."
Yeah, in an alternate universe where this actually is Harrow, we would get to enjoy, as Ianthe expected, like an hour of saucy quips.
Yep. Yep. And unfortunately for Ianthe and for us, that doesn't happen here.
No. So we get to chapter 23, which can just continues chapter 22 with Nona watching a duel. So after Ianthe says, "You're almost a minute late," she approaches and starts to try and banter with Nona, asking about her blinded eyes. And she's upset that Crown didn't tell her that Harrow was blinded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really, I feel like this is a moment where I feel like Cam and Pal put some trust into Corona Beth.
Right.
Because Corona could have very easily been like, no, she's, one, that's not Harrow, and two, she's not blinded, right? But Corona Beth kept information that Harrow's body's here, but it's not really Harrow in it. Corona Beth kept that information from Ianthe. She also kept information about how Palamedes is actually alive from Ianthe. So I just find that really interesting. Crown obviously loves her sister, but she does not fully trust her and is trying to play her own game here a little bit.
Right. I think we've talked about this before, but I think Crown's ideal situation here is that Ianthe actually joins her and they like run away together. So Crown is still, even though she'll do anything for Ianthe, she's still somewhat loyal to Blood of Eden. She hasn't actually fully betrayed Blood of Eden or Cam or Nona.
Not at all. In fact, the opposite. I feel like she is an asset to them and has very much played her role in this plan, whether or not she knew it or not.
Right.
It's wild to me how shitty Ianthe treats Camilla throughout this whole chapter, calling her, I think right off the bat, the dullest prodigal son.
Yeah.
And asking her if she's reshaped her identity now that her necromancer is gone. I mean, burn, and also fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, she's trying to incite some sort of response from Cam. And actually, Corona Beth sticks up for Cam. And then Cam says, "I don't care." Which I think, yeah, Cam is like above being rattled really by this.
Yeah, she's so evolved at this point. Like, no one's really on Cam's level here.
Right. And I mean, she does care, obviously, that she lost her necromancer. But yeah, Ianthe's stupid freaking pestering is not going to get to her. And I love Ianthe's response. She's like, "I love it when people don't care. Don't care was made to care. Don't care was hung," which is an old nursery rhyme. But I think is also Ianthe kind of saying, like, you will care by the end of this. Like, I'm going to make you care.
Yeah. It's a pretty dark nursery rhyme, by the way. I mean, it's basically saying, if you don't care, you're going to get hung.
Come on. Yeah.
And she also is like, why would anyone care about what I have to say? I'm only a lictor, basically.
Right. So Ianthe continues to try and provoke Nona and Cam. It's kind of a one-way conversation. She's not getting any reaction out of either of them. And she says that she expected Nona to come into the barracks demanding the body of her cavalier. And Nona doesn't even give that any response. And Ianthe asks if Camilla is the better model. It's funny. She says Camilla is the better model because she hardly makes one ass joke a day.
Yeah.
Which I think is really funny.
It's pretty funny. Also funny because I didn't notice this before, but Ianthe did not interact with Gideon almost at all.
Right.
Until the off-screen parts between Harrow the Ninth and Nona the Ninth.
Right.
And so the fact that Ianthe has something to say about Gideon here, about making ass jokes, indicates that she's spent some time with Gideon. And I wonder if Camilla picked up on that or not here. Like, I wonder if Camilla's like, maybe part of Gideon is actually alive. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
But maybe she didn't. Because why else would Ianthe kind of like know that core part of Gideon's personality?
Right. She didn't really seem to notice Gideon very much in Gideon the Ninth.
No.
But Ianthe is obviously suspicious of this lack of response. And she kind of gets more serious and she's telling Camilla that God wants the sixth house back. And that he originally thought the sixth house had gotten cooked in the flare after Mercy Morn temporarily killed him, like from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And then was extra depressed, like all over again, when they found out that the sixth house had left voluntarily. And yeah, they get kind of technical, and Ianthe's asking how many, you know, obelisks and steles they needed. And Camilla says they used 532 obelisks to move the entirety of the sixth house.
Yeah. This is interesting, and maybe we'll do some special episode on the mechanics of the river and all of that. Mm-hmm. But Ianthe's like, this, like, the sixth house is so big that it would displace so much of the river. It couldn't, like, move. It couldn't get through.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the steely wouldn't work. So how the hell did they do it? And I think, right, you said 532 obelisks. We don't, like, totally know the science behind all of that. But it doesn't really matter. The fact that this was a major operation and something that no one outside of the sixth house thought could happen, including God.
Right.
And Ianthe's essentially like, I don't really give a shit about the sixth house oversight body. I don't need all of them. I just need one person to interrogate, but otherwise I'm going to kill all of them. And Coronabeth is horrified
right.
by this because she has like maybe a slightly better moral compass than Ianthe. And Ianthe says, it's called the boot, my darling. Did they teach you nothing in that terrorist cell of yours? It's called applying the fucking boot, and I'm going to teach God all about it. He's been very hands-off for the past myriad, lazy, frankly. And now he's reaping what he sowed. It's called fear. I have seen fear, and I understand it now, and I am going to become wonderfully versed in its transmission. I am the saint of awe.
Oh my God, I love that line.
Yeah.
In this world where it's kind of God and Ianthe ruling the universe, Ianthe is in so many ways way worse than John. I mean, I think her priorities would be different, but she would be much more sort of hands-on.
Total tyrant.
Right. I just think it's so interesting. And I also think it's interesting that she says she has seen and experienced and understands fear because of all the bad shit that she's gone through. And that she's going to use that knowledge to become wonderfully versed in its transmission. And I think about how, yeah, like the worst people often had horrible things done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they learned how to be shitty.
Totally.
So I just think it's so interesting. And I also know that there's, you know, sort of this plan maybe that Ianthe and Coronabeth have where I think it's just like they rule the universe together. And in that world, it's not good.
No. I think Coronabeth feels like she would be good.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be good. But Ianthe very clearly wouldn't be. I mean, she is going to rule by fear. This is what dictators do. And that's the kind of government that Ianthe would have.
Right.
And in a funny way, Camilla is smiling in response to this.
Right, which is the one thing that I think could have really set Ianthe off.
Yep.
Because Camilla, remember, Camilla's not a big smiley person. She doesn't smile very often.
That's why you know this is part of the, like, psychological game that Cam is playing with Ianthe right now.
Right.
Because Ianthe just made this incredible ruler-esque statement in this shitty room that they're in. And then Camilla's just, like, smiling at her. That was her reaction. And if there's anything else that would tick Ianthe off, it's, like, not knowing some very key information.
Yeah, like not being in on the joke.
Right. And so Camilla's like, do you know why the sixth house moved? And Ianthe's like, I can't remember the exact line, but she's like, I've read really annoying sixth house books on kids using logic to save the world, and I hope you all die or something, you know, something to that extent.
Yeah, she thinks it's moral philosophy.
Right. But we know the sixth house is way more than moral philosophy. And Camilla says as much and shares that they left for a lictor. Their lictor being Cassiopeia I, left us instructions years ago.
Right. It's the first thing that really seems to throw Ianthe off. Like, it stops her in her tracks.
She's like, oh, shit. Yeah. She's like, fuck, another, well, I think she says, duplicitous slut.
Yep. Yeah, but we already knew this because we knew about the break clause.
Right. The reader knew about this, but Ianthe didn't, which is even more of a burn to Ianthe. Even we know, the readers in Ianthe doesn't know. And so she's thinking about this like, ugh, I don't need God to know about this. He's already so depressed and difficult to work with. Mm-hmm. And now he's just going to be even more depressed that another lictor betrayed him.
Right. And interestingly, she confronts Pyrrha, who she thinks is Gideon the First, and says, you said that she was dead. And Pyrrha says, yes, she is. We watched her die. And Ianthe is like frustrated by this. And Pyrrha says, Cassie played long games. And, you know, one of the main theories that people have about the messenger is that it's some variation of Cassiopeia or instructions left by Cassiopeia, that like kind of this whole plan is set up by Cassiopeia. Which this would be, I think, one supporting piece of evidence for that.
Totally.
And like, we watched her die. They did, but we don't even really know. We don't know.
Well, I went back and read this in Harrow, at least the description, very briefly. She baited a resurrection beast, physical body into the river.
Right.
And she never came out. They didn't actually, at least in the description that they share in Harrow about her death, they don't actually see her again. She just never comes back out of the river.
Well, they do. Mercy Morn says that she watched her. She was laying stakes for the beast and that she got torn apart by 10,000 million ghosts or whatever. But I mean, I think they also say she gets pulled down into the river. And I mean, who knows? Who knows?
Well, and if you think about how Palamedes creates his river bubble.
Right.
I'm curious, how did he know how to do that? There must be some body of research on the sixth house. You know, like, did he really figure that out on his own? Maybe. But there had to have been something that led him to believe that that was possible. And right. I just wonder if there's something like that with Cassiopeia, who is the one also, by the way, who shared with Mercy and Augustine about blood wards and it being at the cellular level, which is when you read Harrow the Ninth and you read Palamedes' description of how he built the river bubble, he did it at a cellular level where he built like a web, which was like all of his cells connected, like are tying him to his bones or whatever. And so I think that Cassiopeia had laid the groundwork for Palamedes to figure all of this stuff out, which, again, I know there are lots of theories around maybe Cassiopeia is alive. And more as I'm reading this, I think that she could be. I mean, she could also just be, whatever, preserve some sort of actual message or information that Blood of Eden is carrying around. Or she could be alive because we know you can break the soul up in all of these different pieces.
Yeah, she could also be dead. even if she was dead, it could still have been that she set this whole thing up. She planted the seed about the cell wards. She did the break clause, like all the stuff. We wouldn't need her to be alive for all of this to be working out. But yeah, I think it's totally possible that she is alive, or she tied herself to her ceramics collection. Who knows?
Exactly. Exactly. But we digress.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why, Mel, this is why we need a whole other episode just for these theories.
Yeah.
But this is the moment where Corona Beth starts to, she kind of breaks down and she kneels in front of Ianthe and begs her to come away with her. And Ianthe says there's no going back. And Ianthe also says, but we're closer to the goal than ever before. So once again, Ianthe also is playing the long game. She has some sort of plan. Remember in Harrow, she's like, I'm very good at seeing the big picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Her big picture, we still don't really know what it is. I think it's that she wants to rule the universe with Corona Beth kind of as the face of the universe and Ianthe as the brains behind it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we'll find out. I am certain.
Right.
So when we get some like weird Ianthe crown interactions, and Moira Quirk obviously reads this in a very sexually charged way, in my opinion, whether or not it is, y'all, we're not debating it, but we will just state the facts. Crown kisses Ianthe's fingers, all the puppets twitch, and Crown loses Ianthe when, you know, she says that other people need them. So they're, again, in this back and forth. Ianthe is like, you're always someone else's girl.
Right.
Ianthe intends for Crown and herself to be together, but on her own terms, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ianthe asks Pyrrha where the breathers are. So these are the people who are not dead, because, like we said, everyone else in the room here, they're puppets. They're dead. Ianthe's puppeting them. And Pyrrha says five of them are outside of Deuteros's room and the rest are on standby. What we find out later is that Pyrrha's actually killed all of them or incapacitated them downstairs. But Pyrrha kind of set this up so that Cam and Pal could go and retrieve Gideon's body.
Yeah, and we have to remember that if Ianthe were here in the flesh, she would be able to sense exactly where any living person was.
Yeah.
So this is another clue into what capabilities Ianthe lacks in this sort of puppeted Nibirius form.
Yep.
So she doesn't know. She has to ask. And that's a huge boon to our crew because, you know, otherwise this plan wouldn't really work.
Yep. So then this epic moment happens that triggers essentially the rest of the chapter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why don't you share it, Amy?
Yeah. So after all of this back and forth with Cam and with Corona Beth, suddenly Prince Ianthe Nibirius comes towards Nona and confronts her and says, Harrow Hark is never this quiet, and is kind of like right up in her face. And Nona doesn't know how to respond. And Cam's advice when she didn't know how to respond was to act like the captain. And so she takes this advice and acts like the captain with blue madness and screams. But when Nona screams, it is not a normal scream. It is not like the captain's scream. Something crazy happens. And it says that Nona went away from herself briefly. So I think whatever she did, it sounds almost like she's torn her throat out physically, and she passes out or blanks out for a second.
Probably so that her throat could heal itself.
Maybe. But we have to remember that Nona is not a human experiencing the effects of blue madness. She is the blue madness. She is a resurrection beast.
Right. And she lets part of that come out here. I think
in
Nona's mind, she is screaming, help, help, help.
Uh-huh.
But no one else hears it that way. They hear it as yeah. like something, you know, like something that makes people go mad.
Uh-huh.
Necromancers in particular. When she wakes up, we don't know how much time has passed. It can't have been that much time. She passes out for maybe like a minute.
I mean, max, I think it's a couple seconds, but yeah. Things happen very quickly.
Things happen quickly. Everyone is down. Like, Pyrrha is on her hands and knees, having drawn a gun. Crown is flanked by dead people. Camilla has unsheathed her knives and is being held by several dead people. Ianthe is getting up off the floor. But many of the dead people don't get back up. Ianthe orders one of the puppets to hold Nona and hold her mouth shut. She commands Pyrrha to get ready to leave within the hour. But I think in all of this, Ianthe's like, okay, oh my yeah. God.
She's like, wow.
All right, then.
Well, then. Yeah, this yeah. changes everything. Yeah, I don't think Ianthe really knows what's happening, but she's like, this has gone too far. We're taking mm-hmm. you back.
I also think in this, Ianthe has slashed Camilla's chest with her sword.
Yes, right.
And so what I can imagine happening is that this sound happens. Ianthe's like, what the fuck? And goes for Camilla. And Camilla's got her knives. Or like Camilla goes for Ianthe when the scream happens.
I think that's what it is. I think that Camilla is basically taking this moment as yeah. the moment to touch Ianthe.
Right. And fails.
Yes. Yes.
And that's, I also think, why Pyrrha draws her gun, because she sees Camilla go for Ianthe, and it's like, oh, fuck, right? So it is just, everyone is not at their best in this moment. Ianthe's like, we need to get the fuck out of here. And in doing so is basically like, Camilla, you have two choices. I can dismember you and pack you up for interrogation, or I can kill you now. And Camilla thinks about it for a long time. I think that what she's thinking is, what is the best way for me to get close enough to Ianthe to, like, touch her here? Trying to figure out, what do I do? How do I get this? I'm assuming that the plan around the duel, I imagine that she and Pal already talked about how to get her to duel Ianthe, unless Camilla just came up with this idea in the moment. I don't know.
What I think happened, and there's no way to prove this. It could be Camilla. It could be they came up with this earlier. But I actually think that in this moment, it's Palamedes.
Oh.
And Palamedes is having a Palamedes moment where he's like, shit, our original plan failed. What are we going to do? And with his big Palamedes brain, he's like, oh, here's an opportunity.
Right.
We can accept the third's challenge.
Right. I'm going to go with you on that, because this definitely feels like a Palamedes plan or audible, you know?
And also, it kind of seemed, I don't know if this is actually a rule, but it kind of seemed in Gideon the Ninth that it was the necromancers who accept
right.
the challenges.
Right.
And it almost seems like this is Pal, and he's, as a necromancer, he's like, I had the right of reply to put my cavalier up against this person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, man, I love this. I like tear up a little bit when I read this part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Camilla, or it could be Pal, says, you challenged the sixth for its keys. You named the time. You backed down, but I had right of reply. We didn't consent or reject. I accept the challenge of the third. That's literally so sick, dude.
Yeah. Also, I love a throwback. Two books past.
Yeah.
You know, it's so wonderful.
It's kind of giving Harrow the Ninth Matthias Nonius.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Totally.
Mm-hmm.
And Ianthe's like, that was ages ago. Like, yeah. What are you even talking about? And then shit goes down between Crown and Ianthe, which I found very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So Ianthe's refusing this duel. Crown grabs Pyrrha's gun and holds it to her throat and essentially threatens to kill herself if Ianthe does not accept the duel.
Right. There's a funny moment here where, I mean, I guess not funny. Crown is threatened to commit suicide, and Ianthe says, stop being so fucking dramatic. And Crown mimics her in a high-pitched voice, stop being so fucking dramatic. And that's a callback from Harrow the Ninth, when I think Harrow's talking to Augustine, and she's like, you and your cavalier were wedded? And it says, he did not turn a hair at wedded, or, as Ianthe would, say back exactly what you had said in a high-pitched voice.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I did not get that.
So when Ianthe would do that to Harrow, it's because that's what she and Corona would do to each other.
I see.
And then Ianthe's like, you're not really going to do it. And Crona's like, no, I really am going to do it, unlike when we were teens. So meaning that Corona Beth has in the past threatened to kill herself to get something she wants from Ianthe.
Which is, by the way, very fucked up.
Yeah, dude, this is like, I don't know if this wins the award for most fucked up relationship in the books. I mean, it's really between them and the Eighth House in Gideon the Ninth. But yeah, it's messed up.
Yeah, I think it's super, super, super fucked up. And she also says, if I kill myself, you're going to become the crown princess of Ida like you never wanted. So again, I think the idea that Corona Beth remains the face of rulership with Ianthe behind the scenes.
Right.
So they've always had this plan together, right? This like dynamic and plan. It's messed up, and it actually works on Ianthe here. So clearly Corona knows that this will work. It's worked before, and it works again, where Ianthe's like, okay, fine, I'll duel her.
Well, I feel like it's actually Ianthe breaks down and agrees to it when Crown calls Ianthe her necromancer.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
It's this weird, like oh, my yeah. necromancer.
Yeah. She's like, you always do things for me, don't you? My heart's own, my necromancer. And Prince Ianthe Nibirius shuddered. Shuddered. Ugh. And again, the way the Moira Quirk reads this is like so, whatever, sexual. Again, that's Moira Quirk's take. We're not debating it, but it's weird.
Yeah, yeah. But whatever is going on, this seems to work on Ianthe. And she's like, fucking fine, I'll do it. Crown puts the gun down and asks Corona Beth to arbitrate the duel. And Corona Beth's like, well, what's winning look like for Camilla? Because you're dead. She can't kill you. And Ianthe takes out this lavender handkerchief and stuffs it in her shirt. And is like, fine, if you can get this off of me, you win. And you can walk away free, presumably.
And Camilla says, well, can I keep it?
Yeah.
Which is, it's a not really a Camilla thing to say, I feel. I feel, I'm actually, ever since you said maybe Palamedes is still kind of hanging out here, I wonder if Palamedes is still here even now in this moment, because I'm like, Camilla's usually not this funny, but Pal is. But who knows? Maybe with the soul permeability thing, they're already kind of becoming each other, so... Anyway, it's funny.
Yeah, I definitely thought that it's a nice handkerchief. Seems very Camilla to me. But can I keep it? Yeah.
I don't know. It's just funny and weird. There's like so much weird little humor in here for such a dark thing that's being discussed and that is happening.
Right. I tried to find clues on whether it was Camilla or Palamedes by reading through the text and looking for their body movements and body language, because usually Palamedes is a little bit more relaxed and chill and Camilla is always shuffling, but I didn't find anything, right. So who knows?
Who knows?
So finally, they agree to the terms and Corona Beth arbitrates and Ianthe and Camilla begin to duel. Camilla takes out her two swords, and they begin, but as you might imagine, Ianthe is in perfect sword fighting shape while Camilla hasn't had anyone to really practice with. Not only because, you know, she wasn't surrounded by a bunch of cavaliers, but also because fighting with a sword on this planet would be kind of a death sentence.
Right.
But I originally thought this was because she had been fighting Augustine back on the Mithraeum, but what it's actually referring to is the fact that she's been dueling against Gideon or Kiriona.
Right. So it makes sense that Ianthe's like an incredible sword fighter. Mm-hmm. I think she, you know, attributes that to being able to have Nibirius's talents. Mm-hmm. But then really and truly, who is a better sword fighter? I think it was Gideon anyway. So yeah. She's got the perfect storm of support around making her a really good fighter. And it seems as though
Ianthe wins this battle. I think it goes back and forth. Looks like at one point Camilla's up on top and then Ianthe is and Nona's freaking out. But Ianthe dodges Camilla's attack. She kicks Cam's leg out from under her and stabs Cam in the stomach. I remember when I first read this, I was like so upset. And then a split second later, you know, like right immediately after, Camilla says, match to the sixth. And right. Ianthe seems to pass out. And the first time I read this, I was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's so good.
We honestly didn't get to see what happened here for a long time until the unwanted guest came out. And that gave us a little bit more insight into what happens next.
Right. Although I have to say, Amy, I'm pretty sure in our Nona reaction episode, I did say something about how I thought that Palamedes and Ianthe were like having a sword fight in their brain or whatever.
Oh my gosh, called it.
I don't think I used the bubble, but I'm pretty sure I said that. And then I was like, I would love to see a short story about what happens here. And bada bink, bada booty.
Yeah.
I wasn't right about everything, but I did get the short story.
Yes. Yeah, it was honestly, it was perfect. And instead of continuing on in our next episode with Nona the Ninth, we're going to take a little skirt and go to The Unwanted Guest, which is Tamsin Muir's short story that she released in the fall. And if you haven't read it yet, you should go read it. It's on tor.com.
It is on tor.com and it's on the paperback version of Nona the Ninth. But for free on tour, so.
Right.
Go read it before you listen to the next episode or you will be spoiled.
Spoilt. Although I'm not exactly sure what the next episode, what really, well, anyway, we'll discuss that then, what we actually learn in that episode. But it is really brilliantly written and so freaking fun to read.
Yeah. All right.
So let's go ahead and move on to audience questions. We're just going to do a couple today. There's one fun fact that I hadn't realized. I don't think we mentioned this at all. Or if we did, we didn't really elaborate. But we had a couple people write in about the name Palamedes. So Margie says Palamedes was a counselor to Agamemnon in the Trojan
Agamemnon.
Agamemnon. Which is the first time I've heard the name Agamemnon. Since like sixth grade.
I feel like for me, I didn't hear the name Agamemnon until college.
This is what I got for being randomly homeschooled for 2 years. I just got like Roman classical literature and nothing else.
Oh my God.
And then Alan wrote in and kind of elaborated on this. I thought this was really interesting. I saw this on Wikipedia about Palamedes. When Odysseus tried to avoid going to the Trojan War, Odysseus tried to avoid it by feigning lunacy, as an oracle had prophesied a long-delayed return home for him if he went. He hooks a donkey and an ox to his plow, as they have different stride lengths, hindering the efficiency of the plow, and, some modern sources add, starts sowing his fields with salt. Palamedes, at the behest of Menelaus's brother, Agamemnon.
Menelaus.
Seeks to disprove Odysseus's madness and places Telemachus. Guys, I'm sorry. If you're like a Greek Roman type scholar, I'm not. I just am not. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Anyway, this is Odysseus's infant son, and he puts him in front of the plow. Odysseus veers the plow away from his son, thus exposing his stratagem. And Alan had this really, really cool theory that maybe Palamedes, or Paul, I guess, will find a way to sort of to put Gideon in front of John at the last minute. So somehow, like, at the last minute, John will be about to destroy the world or something, and Paul will find a way to get Gideon in front of John to stop him from doing that. That basically this story plays out in Alecto the Ninth.
Interesting.
And I thought that was so interesting and smart.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alan.
It's amazing how much you all know about all of these different things. It is quite fun to be enlightened by all of you, even if Amy cannot read or pronounce these names.
You had titty on ya, so.
I did have titty on ya, but that was arguably a really great mispronunciation.
It was. Oh, and then we had B. Hazelton wrote in saying, I'm looking for other sci-fi fantasy to read as we wait for Electo. You both often talk about other authors' novels that you're reading. Any chance you create a recommended reading list on the website? Maybe you can get listener contributions too. Just a thought. Thank you for the pod and all your work. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I think this is a great idea, but certainly right now, before we put anything on the website, we can talk about a book or two that we're reading right now.
Yeah, I will say I would love to put something on our website. However, I do read a lot of books I don't love. Yeah. So I'm like, it's hard because I read so much. So it's, I don't want to put anything on that I'm not like, yeah, this is awesome.
Right.
But Amy, what have you read lately that you are enjoying?
It's not a new book. It's actually one of my favorite series of all time. In fact, it's probably rivaling The Locked Tomb.
Can I guess?
Sure, go for it.
Is it Martha Wells' Murderbot?
Oh, I do love those books. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. If you just want some freaking competence porn to just make you feel a little bit better about the world, read those books. But that's not what I'm talking about. Those are like candy to me. I read those in a sitting,
yeah.
And I'm just like, yes, please fix every problem that comes your way, Murderbot.
Totally. Okay, so what is it, Ames?
So I love these books. It's a trilogy of trilogies. I really love the first trilogy the most, and it's the most well-known. And it's called The Realm of the Elderlings. The first book is called Assassin's Apprentice. This is not an obscure fantasy novel. It's like moderately popular. But I would say if you want things that are fast-paced and plot-driven, this is not the book for you. But if you also like kind of character study literature, this is kind of the fantasy version of that. It's first person, just almost like a journal of this one man's life. It's really, really beautifully written. Many, many famous authors have said they wish they could write as well as Robert Hobb, who wrote these books. But it's very slow. Sometimes people complain that it's too slow. But if you don't mind a slow, intimate, beautifully written fantasy story with dragons and magic, but also that could literally be a non-fantasy book and it would still be good, I recommend The Assassin's Apprentice and all of those. I love those books. I listen to them. I think they're so good. They're so comforting to me, and I love them.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have not read this series. I suppose I should pick it up.
Yeah. If you love it, you love it. That's kind of how Gideon the Ninth is, though, too, right? In the Locked Tomb books.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that there are other people out there who would also love these books.
Totally. Sweet. Here's a couple I've read recently that I've liked.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't give as detailed of a summary as Amy Sorry. Just did, but some of them are probably pretty well known. It won't be any surprise to anyone listening here, but I read Translation State by Anne Leckie at the end of last year. That was great and very queer. There's no queer romance or anything. It's just sort of like this matter of fact, like this is the world that it is. And it was good. It was really different. It's not what I expected. But I've enjoyed Ancillary Justice and the trilogy along with that by Anne Leckie. Those were so good. So I love Anne Leckie. So I had to read Translation State. I thought it was great. I can't remember if I've talked about this series before, but there's the Scapegracers series by H.A. Clarke. There's two out right now. There's going to be a third. Excellent. Incredible books. Great for young queer people as well. I mean, it's great for everyone, but really awesome and fun, witchy books. I really loved Nettle and Bone by T. Kingfisher. That was really good. It took me a minute to get into it, and then I was really hooked. I listened to that. I listened to it pretty quickly. Very excellent, though.
Yeah.
And then two more recommendations from me. I just finished up the Skybound series by Alex Lunded, and it's YA. The first book is Black Wings Beating. Really awesome representation of an ace character. Mm-hmm. Those were really fun. They're not like incredible books, but I had a good time reading them. And I thought the Ace representation was really great.
Nice.
And then one that I just finished that if you want competency porn, this is also a great one.
Give it
this
to
book
me.
Actually, when I was reading the reviews on Goodreads after I finished, I didn't realize that some people hated this book and then other people really loved it. I'm in the love camp, but it's called Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies.
Uh-huh.
And it's the protagonist is I think on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I just freaking love this book because it was like she's so highly competent and it just felt so comforting to me
mm-hmm.
throughout. I think some people thought it was really slow, but I just thought it was so beautifully written and I loved the main character and I really enjoyed the kind of little bit of world building that was going on there. So I'd recommend that.
Oh my gosh, I gotta check it out.
I think you would like that one, Amy, because you liked, you know, Legends and Lattes. It's like got that like comforting vibe about it.
Have we talked about Legends and Lattes?
No, because I haven't read it yet.
Okay, well, everyone out there, including Mel, should read Legends and Lattes. I'm not the first person to say this, but if you just need to take a break from the world for a second, I just thought it was so sweet and totally unexpected. I haven't read the second one yet. I feel like I only need one of those books, but it was really charming.
Yeah. So then I think maybe Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies might be for you, Amy, because you like both Murderbot for the competency and then Legends and Lattes for the comfort, and this is kind of a combo.
Love to hear it. Love to hear it.
All right, y'all. That's a wrap.
Yeah. That's all we have for today. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Thanks for bearing with us. I know it's been a bit, but we have, you know, we got lives to live, and I'm glad we're back here recording. Also, it sounds like Alecto is not going to be out in 2024, so I do feel like we have plenty of time, and we want to keep on taking it slow and making sure that we do every episode to the best of our ability. So very sad about Alecto, but also Tamsin Muir can take as long as she wants. I'm just so pumped to be part of this community and to have this. Honestly, once it's out, then it's out. And then I can't
then
wait
what?
For the next book.
I know. I can't even think about that.
I know. Yeah. Let's not. All right. Anyway, so if you have comments or questions or want to point out something that we missed, message us on our website, locktoonpod.com. Or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at LockToomPod. Our next episode will cover the unwanted guest. So if you haven't read that, go read it now. As always, if you liked this podcast, tell your friends to listen and rate and review us wherever you're listening to this. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locktoom Podcast.